Okay, so here we are in chapter 4. Chapter 4 is on demand supply. This is the first lecture. And we just saw a video that gave an overview of the basics of demand and supply. But it'll take us two class periods really to cover what the video covered. So I really didn't expect you to understand everything on that video. It's just a brief overview. But let's start with the market, because we are still a market-driven economy. A free enterprise system is a market-driven economy. So we have to understand what the market is. So what is a market? Well, market is where a group of buyers and sellers meet with the potential to trade. Like we do our grocery shopping at a supermarket. That's a market. Why is it a market? Well, everyone knows that if you go to Kroger's or Food Lion, that there's a bunch of food there for sale. And so it's a place where buyers of food and sellers of food can meet. Now, I mentioned before that in economics, we are only concerned if there is a market transaction. I've talked about it before, right? If Ford Motor Company produces a car and that car sits in a parking lot, is that car a part of the supply of cars? Well, no, it's not, because it's not been there's not been a market transaction here. If Ford Motor produces a car and that car sits out in a parking lot, well, so what if it's a car? If it's not driven, it's nothing but a hunk of worthless metal, right? Someone has to purchase it in order that we can say, well, this has value. So what is demand? A relation showing the quantities of a good consumers are willing and able. Notice I underlined the words willing and able. Willing and able to buy at various prices during a given period of time, other things constant. And I'm going to show you what that means here in just a minute. But the demand curve shows us how many units a consumer will buy that they're willing and able to buy at various prices. See, what is a demand curve? A curve showing the quantities of a commodity demand at various possible prices, other things constant. Now, what this other things constant means is that, and this may be the most important thing that you can learn in this chapter, at least to understand these demand supply curves, and that is that when we change price, we always assume that nothing else changes. Now, for example, if the price of a new Cadillac, went down by, let's say, 20%, what would you say might happen? Well, you might say at a lower price, especially if it's 20-25%, that more people will buy Cadillacs. But what happens if at the same time the prices of other luxury cars goes down by 50%? See, if the price of Cadillacs goes down by 20%, but the price of other luxury cars goes down by 50%, then can we say that consumers will buy more Cadillacs? Well, we can't say that, right? I mean, we couldn't come to that conclusion. Therefore, if I say that the price of Cadillacs has gone down by 20%, and then I say that as a result, the quantity demanded will increase, what assumption do I have to make? Well, I have to make the assumption that nothing else is changing except the price of Cadillacs. Now, this is highly important to understanding demand-supply curves. When the price changes, we always, 100% of the time, we always assume that nothing else is changing. Just the price of this product is changing. That's it. And then we can come to certain conclusions. But if we didn't make that assumption, then we could not come to any definitive conclusion. So what is a change in the quantity demanded? A movement along the demand curve in response to a change in the price, other things constant. Now, when we change price, demand does not change. Now, here is something that you've got to understand or you're going to get confused. And the understanding is one of vocabulary. That's it. But it's a little tricky at this point. See, when price changes, the quantity demanded changes as we're moving along a demand curve. If price goes up, the quantity demanded goes down. I mean, people buy less as the price goes up. And as the price goes down, people buy more. So we say when the price goes down, the quantity demanded increases. But demand itself does not change, because when we change price, we're moving along a stationary curve, okay? So the biggest challenge to you is, and you don't have to understand it right now, because I'm going to reinforce this over, you know, this lecture and the next lecture, so you've got plenty of time to absorb this. But what I'm saying is that you've got to train your ear that a change in a quantity, as price changes, there's a change in the quantity demanded. But if demand is going to change, something has to change other than price. So if I say price changes, there's a change in the quantity demanded, it would be incorrect for me to say that there was a change in demand. But again, I'm going to reinforce this as we go along. See, why do demand curves have a negative slope? At a higher price, consumers will buy fewer units, and at a lower price, they will buy more units. Well, that, you know, a lot of what we're going to cover in this chapter is really just common sense. So don't make it more difficult than it really is. See, economists love to draw pictures, especially when you get to demand and supply. So we've got lots of graphs in this chapter. But really, I could teach it without graphs, okay? But it's customary to use graphs while teaching this. But the point I'm making is that don't get all caught up with the graphs. Don't get all caught up with the curves. Just step back 10 paces and look at the bigger picture and use your common sense, because this is just really common sense, all right? So don't make it more difficult than it really is. So it's just common sense to say, okay, at a high price, people buy less, and at a low price, people buy more. At a high price, if price goes up, the quantity demanded goes down. As the price goes down, the quantity demanded goes up. Just simple, common sense. What does an inverse relationship between price and quantity mean? Now, another challenge to you in this chapter is simple vocabulary. Vocabulary, that's it. So in fact, a lot of economics is just learning a new vocabulary. And so inverse, what is an inverse relationship? Well, an inverse relationship means that two things move in opposite directions. So in other words, if we say that if the price goes up, the quantity demanded goes down, well, that's an inverse relationship. Price goes up, quantity demanded goes down. Price goes down, quantity demanded goes up. That's what we call an inverse relationship. See, when we get to supply, we're going to find that there's a direct relationship between price and quantity. price goes up, the quantity supply goes up. See, that's a direct relationship. But now we're simply talking about a demand, and so we're talking about an inverse relationship. Because now, here's another thing I want you to understand, is that all that we're doing here in this chapter is that we're acting as painters. I mean, imagine yourself out in the field somewhere with a canvas and you know, some paintbrushes, and you're looking out into you know, the country, and you're simply painting. You're trying to paint what you see. Well, that's what we're doing here in this chapter. See, we're not trying to design anything. We're simply impartial observers. As economists, we're looking out there in the economy, we witness certain things happening, and we're simply drawing a picture of what we witness is happening. All right? So that's why I say it's just, this is a lot of us just common sense, because it's just an explanation of the things that you witness every day. So what is the law of demand? The quantity of a good demanded is inversely related to its price, other things constant. So what we say is that when the price goes up, the quantity demanded goes down, because that's what people do. We call this the law of demand. Now, that's not a law that says that, like the law of gravity is true all the time. And I don't know that this is true all the time. So I don't know if we should really call it the law of demand, but that's what we call it in economics. Okay, we call it the law of demand, meaning that if the price goes down, we're going, you know, we observe that people buy more, and the price goes up, people buy less. I mean, there's some assumptions here that we have to actually make in order to come to this conclusion. You know, one assumption that the fellow in the video, the professor in the video, mentioned, was that we're assuming that the economy is made up of economic persons, and an economic person is a person who would rather have more than less. I mean, if I gave you a choice of a $50 bill and a $1 bill, which would you choose? I mean, everything else being equal, well, most people would choose the $50 bill, right? So that's all we're assuming. I mean, that would be an example of an economic person. An economic person is a person that, given a choice, everything else being equal, would rather have more than less. So so there are certain assumptions here that we have to make in order, you know, for all this demand-supply stuff to really work out as it does. Now, what is a demand schedule? Well, again, this is just vocabulary. A demand schedule shows a specific quantity of a good or service that people are willing and able to buy at different prices. And a demand schedule, this is price of milk, and it's on a table. And so as the price goes down on the first row, our column, the quantity demanded goes up. In other words, price goes down, quantity demanded goes up. Now, economists love to draw pictures, and sometimes they use tables, and sometimes they use graphs. Now, the advantage in a table over a graph is that a table can be more specific, whereby a graph, it has an advantage of showing us the bigger picture better. So if an economist wants to be very specific, he may use a table. But if he wants to show the bigger picture, then he'll use a graph. Now, if we show a table, we call it a demand schedule. If we use a graph, we call it a demand curve. And that's really the only difference. that's not really critical for your understanding. And here we have the demand curve for milk. Now, here we have a fall in price. Now, let me do that again. Uh-oh. Let's see. Now, how do I get back? Previous? Yeah. Now, watch this. As the what I want you to witness is, as the price goes down, does any of you notice that the demand curve or demand changes? Well, see, as price goes down, does demand change? Demand's not changing, right? See, demand's staying the same, right? Price goes down. Well, that demand curve's not changing. Now, when price goes down, what does change? Well, what does change is the quantity demanded as illustrated down here on the horizontal axis. Right? At $1.25, we got 8 units. At 25 cents, we got 32 units. Now, let me do that again. Price goes down or price changes. What's changing? Is demand changing? No, demand's not changing. What's changing? The quantity demanded is changing as illustrated on the horizontal axis. Now, it's customary in economics that price is always on the vertical axis and quantity is always on the horizontal axis. That's just custom. Now, why do consumers buy more as price decreases and less when price increases? Now, here, see, I might say, okay, as an economist, I understand that when the price goes up, people will buy less. And then you ask me, well, why is that true? And I say, well, it's true because, well, it just is. Well, that wouldn't be very scientific. And economists like to think that they're, that economics is more like a science. So they want to come up with, even though something is obvious, they still want to come up with certain explanations so that they can say, hey, you know, this is why. And so that's what we get with the substitution effect and the income effect. These are two different explanations that economists give of why there's an inverse relationship between price and quantity. So we're going to look at each one, the substitution effect first. So what is the substitution effect? When the price of a good falls, consumers will substitute it for other goods which are now relatively expensive. Now, the word relative is important. See, if you let's say you go to the store to buy a can of beans, and there are maybe 3 or 4 different brands, but they're all the same size. The cans hold the same volume of beans. And in your mind, one can of bean is, you know, equal to the other. All right, so we got these cans of beans. The higher price can is 35 cents, and the lower price can is maybe 30 cents. Now, which are you going to buy? Well, everything else being equal, you know, you got several cans, several different companies here, but you think they're all the same, so you're going to buy the less expensive one, correct? Now, let's say 2 weeks later, you go back to buy a can of beans, and again, they're different prices, but now the lowest price can is 35 cents. See, that the first time it was only 30 cents, but now the lowest price can is 35 cents, and the others are more expensive. So which can are you going to buy? Well, you're going to buy the can that's worth this price of 35 cents because it's the less expensive one. Well, the point I'm making is did you make your decision based on 35 cents? No, you didn't make a decision based on 35 cents. You made your decision which can to buy based on the relative price, not the absolute price. So you might not even notice a difference. I mean, 2 weeks have gone by, and you might not have even remembered that 2 weeks ago, the less expensive can was only 30 cents. And now, the less expensive can is 35 cents. You might not even realize that. I mean, all you're doing is that you're looking at different prices here, and you're picking the lowest priced can of beans. See? So it's the relative price that's important, usually, and not the absolute price. Yeah, you have a question?
Did you argue that the quality could be better? That's the reason why.
Well, no. I'm assuming here that you think these cans are the same. No, of course. I mean, if you think the quality of one is better than the others, then you'd be willing to pay a higher price. But no, but my assumption here was that, you know, that in your mind they're all the same. So the only thing that you're basing your decision on is the relative price. Of course, when you talk about relative price, we're talking within a certain price range, right? Like if you go to shop for a can of beans and the less expensive can is $100, well, you're not going to spend $100 on a can of beans, right? But, you know, you got to use your common sense with this stuff, right? But, you know, within a certain price range, then you're going to make a decision based on the relative price and not the absolute price, everything else being equal. See, there again, you know, we say, we change one thing, in this case, price, and then we say, well, now, what will a consumer do, everything else being equal? Which, in this case, would mean that all the cans of beans are, you know, same quality and, you know, they're the same. So that's the substitution effect, that you will substitute a less expensive can of beans for a more expensive can of beans. See, that's called the substitution effect. Now, the income effect, I just have to backtrack a little bit here and explain some vocabulary. What is money income? The number of dollars received per period of time, such as $100 per week. Money income is how many dollar bills do you receive? And, you know, like an income. If you've got a job and you're paid so much money, well, you know, how much dollar bills, or, you know, how much money are you paid? But real income is income measured in terms of the goods and services it can buy. Like if you get, let's say you put money in a bank and you get, the bank pays you, let's say, 5% interest. In today's world, that would be pretty good. But let's say a bank pays you 5% interest over 12 months. But in that 12 months, prices have increased by 5%. So when you take your money out at the end of 12 months, the buying power of that $100 is the same as it was a year ago, even though you've got, well, if you put $100 in a year ago, now you've got $105. But the buying power of the $105 is the same as $100 was a year ago because of inflation. So if you get a 5% return on your savings, but inflation is 5% in the same time period, then we say that your money income may have increased. You know, you're getting back more dollars than you put in, but your real income has stayed the same because your buying power has not increased. Now, what's more important in terms of your well-being, your money income or your real income? Well, what's more important is real income. I mean, people might be fooled for a short time with an increase in money income, but it doesn't take long for them to realize that, hey, you know, I'm making more dollar bills, but seems like when I go buy things, because of the higher prices, I'm worse off than I was before. So it doesn't take long for people to realize that there's been a change in their real income despite what's happened to their money income. Because people are pretty smart. So now that you know the difference between money income and real income, now I can talk about the income effect. Now, what are we doing here? What we're doing is that what we say in economics is that the price goes down, the quantity demand goes up, and as the price goes up, the quantity demand goes down. Why is that true? Because of two reasons. The substitution effect is one explanation. The income effect is another explanation. See? Two explanations of why there's inverse relationship between price and quantity. So we've talked about the substitution effect. Now we're going to talk about the second reason why there's inverse relationship between price and quantity, and that's the income effect. So what is the income effect? A fall in the price of a good increases consumers' real income. Right? The fall in the price, fall in prices, increases your real income. See, even if you don't get a raise, let's say you got a job and you don't get a raise, well, your real income is going to increase. Even though you're getting the same number of dollar bills in your paycheck, your real income is going to increase if the prices of things that you buy go down. Okay, making them more able to purchase all goods so the quantity demanded increases. So what we're saying is that if the price goes down, consumers' real income goes up. As consumers' real income goes up, their buying power increases. Therefore, they will buy more. So that explains why, one explanation of why, when the price goes down, the quantity demanded goes up, and vice versa. Okay, yeah.
So are wages related to this?
Well, wages is income, yeah, that's what I'm talking about, yeah. You know, anytime you receive money, it could be through wages or through interest income or you know, I mean, it's income. It's income if money is coming into you. Yeah. What is individual demand? The demand for an individual consumer. Now, what is the name of this course? The name of this course is The Principles of Macroeconomics, correct? Now, what is the other principles course? I mean, most of you, especially if you're going into a business field, But if you transfer to four-year school, most of you are going to be required to have one semester of macro, principles of macroeconomics, and one semester of microeconomics. Okay? So, yeah. She told me when she came in that she had to leave early, and I really do appreciate that. If you got to leave early, you know, just let me know. So I do appreciate that. Anyway, macroeconomics. In this course, we are not concerned with the individual demand curve because this is macroeconomics. In macroeconomics, we're looking at the economy in the large. It's like we're flying over it in an airplane and we're looking down and we're seeing how everything fits together. So in microeconomics, we may be concerned with the individual demand curve, but in macroeconomics, we're concerned with what is called aggregate demand. Now the word, again, you know, so much vocabulary in economics, aggregate. Aggregate means the summation of or a totality. So in other words, in macroeconomics, we're concerned with overall demand that we call aggregate demand. The summation of all the individual demand curves. Okay, so in macroeconomics, we are concerned with aggregate demand and aggregate supply. Okay, and then in microeconomics, we change our focus. So what is market demand? The sum of the individual demands of all consumers in the market. So that's what we call market demand or aggregate demand. There may be a difference there. I'm not sure. I'm not sure if there is a difference, but the word aggregate is used a lot. Well, the aggregation, you know, the aggregation of something is the summation of its individual parts. So, again, this is just vocabulary. You know, we're talking about market demand or aggregate demand. You know, I think that most of the time you could, you know, use either term.
So what's the difference between market and aggregate?
I don't think there is a difference. Although I wouldn't bet my life on it, there might be. but they both mean, you know, big demand, you know, rather than individual demand. So what is a normal good? You know, oftentimes, in economics, we can use different terms to mean the same thing. I mean, that is pretty common. So same with the, you know, market demand, aggregate demand. I mean, you know, you could use either one. So what is a normal good? A good for which demand increases as consumer income increases. So you might think that as incomes increase, there would be an increase in demand for every good and service, but that's not true. As people's, that's plural, right? Consumers, that's plural. Because again, we're talking about aggregate demand or market demand. As people's incomes increase, they will tend to buy more of some goods, but less of other goods. For example, as people's incomes increase, and when we say incomes increase, we always mean real incomes, by the way. Not money income, or their buying power. You know, we're saying their buying power increases. So if people's incomes increases, meaning, see, if I say income, you have to assume that I'm talking about real income. Now, if I want to talk about money income, then I have to say money income. In fact, there's another word the economists use for money, and that's nominal. You know, money income or nominal income mean virtually the same thing. So again, you know, sometimes we use different terms to mean the same thing in economics. But if I say income increases, see, economics is like a game, right? And there are rules to the game. And in order to play the game, you've got, you know, both, you know, all the participants have to know the rules. Well, one of the rules in this game of economics is that if I say income, I mean real income. Okay? If I want to talk about money income, then I have to say money income or nominal income. Okay? That's just, you know, part of the rules of the game. So what is a normal good? A good for which demand increases, a consumer's income increases. As people's incomes increase, they will tend to buy more steak, perhaps, but maybe less hamburger. As people's incomes increase, they may tend to buy more new cars, but as a result, the demand for used cars will go down. See? As people's incomes increase, they buy more of some things and less of other things. Now, those things that people buy more of as their incomes increase, we call normal goods. Things that people buy less of as their incomes increase, we call inferior goods. So in my example, a new car would be a normal good, where a used car would be an inferior good. In my example, steak would be a normal good, where a hamburger would be an inferior good. Okay. Now, when we say normal and inferior, remember, in economics, we define things very succinctly, specifically. Okay? It's not wishy-washy. There is a specific difference between a normal good and an inferior good. See, a normal good is one that people buy more of as their incomes increase. An inferior good is a good that people buy less of as their incomes increase. So see, that's a very definite difference, something you can sink your teeth into. I mean, it's not wishy-washy. It's very airtight. It's very definite. And that's what we try to do in economics. We try to make our definitions, very, very clear. Now, what are complementary goods, complements? Goods that are related in such a way that an increase in the price of one leads to a decrease in the demand for the other. Complements are things that go together, like steak and steak sauce would tend to go together. So as people buy more steak, they will tend to buy more steak sauce because these two things kind of go together. You know, if people buy more hot dogs, they might buy more mustard because, hot dogs and mustard for many people tend to go together. See, those are what are called complementary goods. Now here, you just have to use your common sense. Don't try to commit this to memory. Remember, your memory is your worst enemy in this course. Okay? Don't try to commit these relationships to memory, because just think about it and it just makes sense. See, for example, if the price of steak goes up, what's going to happen to the demand for steak sauce? It's going to go down. That's right. Now, but notice my vocabulary. See, I said that when the price of steak goes up, okay, I say the price of steak goes up, the demand for steak sauce will go down. When I say demand goes down, what I'm saying is that the whole curve is shifting. Okay? With the change in the price of steak, we're moving along a stationary curve because there's a change in the quantity demanded as the price changes. But because steak and steak sauce are complementary goods, there is a decrease in the demand. Now, I didn't say quantity demanded. I said demand. If I say there's a change in demand, that means the whole curve is shifting. Because the whole curve will shift if there's a change in some non-price determinant. Okay, if something has to change other than price for the whole curve to shift. So that's what's happened here. See, when the steak and steak sauce are complementary goods, so if you're looking at steak sauce, well, the whole curve shifts because a non-price determinant change. What was a non-price determinant that changed? It was the price of steak. See? Again, you got to think about it. It's just really common sense. What are substitutes? Well, substitutes are two things that are related that one can be substituted for the other. Now, most things are not related, right? Most goods and services are not related. But what we're saying here is that if, now there's a big word there, if. If two things are related, then they are either related as being complementary goods or they are related as being substitutes. One or the other. Complementary goods, one tends to go along with the other. Substitutes is we can either use this or substitute this for something else. See? Complements, substitutes. Now, what is a change in demand? A shift in a given demand curve caused by a change in one of the non-price, meaning that something is changing here other than price, determinant of demand for the good. See? If I say that demand changes or demand shifts, then what has got to occur is something has to change other than price. We call that a non-price determinant, something that determines demand that's not price. Then we get a shift in the whole curve. But if price changes, then the curve doesn't shift. Rather, we're moving along a stationary curve, all right? Now, here we have got this downward slope and demand curve, and it's downward sloping because there's an inverse relationship between price and quantity, because that's the way, you know, people are. Oh, my gosh. So now, notice here, this is what we mean by an increase in demand. The whole curve now has shifted. That's an increase in demand. It's not an increase in the quantity demanded. See, that would be incorrect for me to say this is an increase in the quantity demanded. It's not an increase in the quantity demanded. It's an increase in demand. Okay? Again, it's just vocabulary, but it's in economics, you know, these two, increase in quantity demand, increase in demand, mean two different things. Just like that's a door. You know, this is a, you know, computer. I mean, you know, a door is a door and a computer is a computer. A change in quantity demand is a change in quantity demand, and a change in demand is a change in demand. Those are two different things. Okay, so again, important, know the difference between a change in the quantity demanded and a change in demand. Can't emphasize that enough. So what can cause a change in the demand for a good or service? And what this little guy is doing here is that he's changing the page. He's turning the page. So if we turn the page, these are six things, non-price determinants, that can cause a shift in demand. So we'll look at each one in turn. And I don't think I do that. No, I don't. Okay, so I'll just take each one with this one slide. A number in the market. What we witness is that if the number of people in the market increases, then there tends to be an increase in demand. Okay, it's just like for a while, Kroger's had a double coupon days. What they would do is that it was interesting how they did it, because they offered double coupons in the first week and the third week of the month. How come? Because a lot of people get paid twice a month, the first and the middle of the month. So what a lot of people do when they get a paycheck is that they do a big grocery shopping. So Kroger's gets a lot of people coming into the store, you know, any grocery store does, in the first week of the month and the third week of the month. But in order to draw more people into the market, they would offer double coupons in the second week of the month and the fourth week of the month to try to draw more people into the market. See, it's the same thing as if you notice when you go to the grocery store, milk and dairy products is always way at the back of the store. Well, why is that? Well, you know, these things don't happen just by happen chance. There's a reason for it. And the reason for it is that people shop for milk and dairy products on a daily basis, often, you know, every other day or every third day. And so if you put those things in the back of the store, well, people have got to pass through many aisles to get there. And on the way to the milk section, they pass by this and they pass by that. And they say, well, oh, that's right. I need some of this and I need some of that. And so, you know, it's all marketing, right? I mean, what, you know, why are boxes of cereals rectangle instead of square? And I've talked about this before, because people, you know, we are all attracted toward that which is familiar to us. And the 2-to-1 ratio is more familiar in nature. So a rectangle box will sell, you know, multiple times more than a square box will, even though everything else is the same. So there are, you know, reasons for these things. So now what I'm saying here is that if Kroger's or Food Lion or wherever you shop, if they can draw more people into the market, then there, what we've learned is that there is a tendency for demand increase. Now, did I say that if we draw more people into the market, that there will be an increase in demand? No, I didn't say that. I didn't say that we're going to be there. We can't say that. We can't say there's going to be an increase in demand. But what we can say is that there, as more people enter into the market, that there is a tendency for there to be an increase in demand. Okay, so that's important too in economics. What we talk about here is people tend to do this or they tend to do that. We don't say they do this or they do that, but there's a tendency here and a tendency there. So, and of course, the opposite is true, you know, is the fewer people that are in the market, then there's a tendency for demand to go down or the demand curve to shift to the left. All right, consumer income can also shift demand curves. Now, keep in mind what the what these six things are. That what these six things are that we're talking about here are reasons why there are non-price determinants. They are reasons why demand curves can shift, move to the right or move to the left. Okay, that's what we're talking about here. So something's changing here other than price is causing a shift in the whole curve. Now, consumer income can change. Now, when if I say consumer income, what income am I talking about? I'm talking about real income, correct? Because, again, that's part of the, you know, that we agreed upon when we play this game of economics. So if consumer income increases, there's going to be an increase in demand for normal goods, but there's going to be a decrease in demand for inferior goods. Okay? Again, shifts and curves. Increase in demand for normal goods, decrease in demand for inferior goods when people's incomes, again, that's plural. We're not talking about an individual consumer here. We're talking about aggregate demand or market demand. Prices of related goods. If two things are related, they can be related as either being complements or substitutes. If the price of a related good changes, then the demand for the first good will change or will shift. How does it shift? Well, that depends on whether the two things related are substitutes or complements. If the two things related are substitutes, then as the price of one goes up, the demand for the other will go down. If the two products or goods that are related as complements, then as the price of the first one goes up, the demand for the other one will go down. Because as people buy less steak, as the price goes up, they will tend to buy, or the demand for steak sauce will tend to go down. Okay? Again, it's just common sense. Don't try to cram this into your brain. Okay? It's not going to work that way, and you just be causing yourself a lot of grief. Okay? Just look at it, think about it, and say, oh yeah, of course. I mean, how else could it be? That makes sense. That's just common sense. Okay. Consumers' expectations can change. Now, here, something that economists recognize is that expectations is a powerful force that determines consumer demand. See, if I, you know, for example, let's say that I was able to spread a rumor that the price of sugar was going to go up a lot. That, you know, for, I mean, let's say that I told all these lies. They're not truths. their lives. But I was able to convince a bunch of people that because of this and because of that, that the price of sugar was going to go way up. Well, if I convince enough people of that, what would a lot of people do? Well, when they went to the store, they instead of buying one bag, they might buy two bags or three bags. So if I convinced a lot of people that we were going to have a shortage of sugar today, then tomorrow we would have a shortage, right? Because a bunch of people would buy two or three bags, and next thing you know, we got a shortage. Well, why do we have a shortage of sugar? Because people expected there to be a shortage. Was there any other reason? No, there's no other reason. If enough people expect a shortage, then we'll get a shortage. If enough people expect prices to go up, like take houses, for example. Let's say that people expect the prices of houses to go up. Now, you've got a certain number of people in the market to buy a house. Now, who is in the market to buy a house? And will everyone buy a house that's in the market? No, what we're talking about here is that there are certain people that are looking, that are thinking of buying a house. They say that's the market. The market are people who are not necessarily going to buy, but if they can find what they want at the price they want to pay, then they'll buy. Well, those people are in the market. Okay? See, I mean, if you go to Kroger's or someplace like that to buy something, but the Kroger's doesn't sell it, well, are you still in the market? I mean, you've walked through the doors, right? You walked through the doors, you looked around, you didn't find what you needed, and you walked out with nothing. But were you in the market? Yeah, you were physically in the market, even though you didn't buy anything, right? So that's what the market is. See, the market are those people who are looking. So if enough people that are in the market to buy houses believe that the price of houses are going to go up a lot in the near future, what will a lot of those people do? Well, a lot of those people will buy now or buy sooner than they would otherwise. Because they'll say to themselves, you know, we haven't found our dream home yet, but by gosh, if we don't buy now, and the price of the house is going to go way up, we may not be able to afford a house next year. I mean, you know, we got to buy now or maybe too late. So we like this house. It's not our dream house, but, you know, we got to do something now, so let's buy it now. Let's buy this house now instead of, shopping around for another year. So now, why did people buy more houses? Well, because people thought that the price of houses were going to go up. And as more people bought houses, what happened to the price of houses? Well, they went up. Why did they go up? Because people expected them to go up. See, it all becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Whatever we expect to happen will tend to happen. And there may not be any other reason except that we expect it to happen. If we expect shortages, we get shortages. If we expect higher prices, we get higher prices. Even though there may not be any other reason than our expectations. See, so economists recognize that expectations is a powerful force. If enough people expect the prices in the stock market to go up, what will they do? More people will buy than sell. So what happens to the price in the stock market? It goes up. If people expect the prices to go down, what will they do? Well, more people will sell than buy. And what happens? The price goes down. The stock market goes up and down. See, the stock market may go up or down and have no relationship to the economy. None whatsoever. The prices can go up and down totally based on people's expectations. Now, what's tricky about expectations is that it can change overnight. You know, people can go to bed optimistic and wake up pessimistic. I mean, sometimes there's a reason for a change in expectations and sometimes there is no reason. I mean, people are emotional. We're all emotional. And yet, our emotions can dictate demand curves, whether there's reason for it or not. All right, I'm almost done here. We've got a couple more minutes. I think this is going to finish the demand curve, and then next time we'll talk about the supply curve. Consumer demographics. Well, what's demographics? Well, the demographics in Florida is different than the demographics in Canada or in Michigan. You know, the weather is different in Florida than it is in Michigan. There may be a good demand for sunscreen would be a good in Florida maybe, but not so much, you know, in Michigan. Or there might be a good demand for heating systems in Michigan, but, you know, demand more for air conditioners in Florida. I mean, that's called demographics, you know, and demographics can change. Consumer tastes and preferences can change. You know, sometimes there's a reason and sometimes there's not. You know, fads come and go. You know, ties get wider and then they get narrower, and then people don't wear ties. I mean, it's you know, tastes and preferences change. And as tastes and preferences change, then there's either an increase in demand for some things and a decrease in demand for other things. You know, there's especially in the computer field, you know, there's been an increase in demand for many things because, well, technology has changed, and with that change in technology, our tastes have changed. You know, our preferences have changed. See, so what is supply? See, this is a perfect place to stop. So half this chapter is, well, no, a third of this chapter is on demand, a third of this chapter is on supply, and then at the end of the chapter, we put demand and supply together, and we talk about the market. So I'll talk to you about the supply next time.